Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Kevin, guess what?
What, Rob?
We now have over 50 iTunes reviews.
Huzzah!
Huzzah! Indeed! Oh. We are climbing those iTunes rating charts.
That's amazing. Yeah. How do we climb even higher?
Can you take me high enough? Little Rock of Ages for you.
Do you know I like that you took it up so high too? You didn't even you like went right to the tenor place.
I was gonna do
climb. No Robert Goulet.
Like, no. Can you take me high enough?
Thanks for coming out tonight.
Ooh, and my falsetto there.
Thank you.
And a little Sergio Frankie?
Yeah, a little Sergio.
It's never over. Much like the 24-hour buffet down in the lobby of the Dunes Casino, me and Sid the Caesar, two nights only at the Mirage. Sorry. Well, lovely listeners, this is where you come in. This is how we're going to climb those iTunes rating charts.
That's right. Lovely listeners, if you love us, would you go to iTunes, click on the iTunes store, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Then click on Ratings and Reviews. Under the Customer Reviews, click Write a Review. Then let us know what you think from 1 to 5 stars.
That's right. And you can leave comments, too, like Kevin Thomas is a god.
Or, Rob, who the hell is Hervé Villechaize?
Who is Hervé
Villechaize?
Oh, my God. I fell for it again.
You fell for
it. That wasn't even
the
script.
The man has never done one musical in his entire life, and he gets mentioned more than Stephen Sondheim.
Right, but I love him from James Bond. Okay, anyway, guys, help us out. Please.
Thanks, everyone. Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And if that's not enough, follow us on the Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast. Plus, you can always listen to our podcasts on Broadway World and Stitcher.
Our guest today is one of Broadway's most talented and well-known actors, having been on The Great White Way since 1980. While he has portrayed many different characters in his illustrious career, he is perhaps best known to audiences as the lovable but very misguided Franklin Shepard in the infamous and much-beloved Merrily We Roll Along.
Boy, especially this year. I love its comeback.
Yes.
And after Merrily closed, our guest starred in such musicals as Stardust, 42nd Street, and The World Goes Around, Crazy for You, and the hit revivals of Sweeney Todd, The Music Man, and Company.
To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Susan Stroman, Stephen Sondheim, and Patti LuPone, plus how his honesty got him cast in Merrily We Roll Along, here is the wonderful Jim Walton.
Hello, gentlemen.
Welcome.
Great to be here. Jim. First of all, thank you so much for joining us on this cold wintry day.
Oh my goodness. It's my pleasure to come inside.
So we're going to actually start in the middle, and then we're going to jump backwards, which is, I'm sure, a storytelling device familiar with.
I see what you did there, Bob.
Your honesty with Hal Prince get you cast in Merrily We Roll Along?
Well, that's my take on it. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. When I auditioned for Merrily We Roll Along, I was 25 years old, so I was on the older end of the spectrum from what they wanted. I think they wanted, 16 to 22-year-olds.
Right. Yeah, young teenagers.
Yeah.
So I thought I wasn't going to be cast. I just thought I just wanted to meet Prince and Sondheim, which was enough.
Yeah.
But I went through the audition process, and I sang a couple of songs, and I read a scene, to my recollection.
Was this when auditions were on stage of theater?
Well, it was back during those days, but this was not. It was at the Minskoff Rehearsal Studios, which is, I don't know what it is now.
I don't know either.
It's there, but...
Yeah.
And the last question he asked me, he said, "Jim, how old are you?" And then I remember it was like, time went away, and I examined within 2 seconds' time. Well, I could lie and say I'm 22 because I look 22. But then if he found out that I lied, that wouldn't be a good thing.
It's Hal Prince.
Prince. And I just thought, and then a voice said, "Do you really want to get this show on a lie? I mean, do you want to lie to get your..."
No.
So I said, "I'm 25 years old." And he said, "Thank you, Jim." And I thought that was...
like, thank you.
Thanks for... That's all we need today. But anyway...
And it wasn't, was it?
No, they got you in, and you ended up getting a big role out of it, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. Now we're going to jump.
So tell the truth about your age, kids.
Yeah, tell the truth about your
age. You never know.
People will know.
Well, they can find out.
I mean, that was like on my
Facebook, Twitter, they list
easy
everything.
Easy to do.
Yeah. Luckily, everyone in this room is, 20. So we have nothing to worry about, right?
Mm.
Great. Okay,
that's
great.
That's funny, Rob. That's funny.
I have to ask you, do you remember what you sang at your audition?
I love this.
I do remember. I sang "Broadway Baby" from Dames at Sea. "I found me a Broadway baby," that song.
Oh, yeah?
And I also, they let you sing two complete songs.
Complete songs.
My God.
I sang "I've Confessed to the Breeze I Love You" from No No Nanette.
Oh, as a my goodness.
Jim, what great
as
choices.
A ballad.
I confess to the breeze, I love you.
Were those your go-to audition songs when you were auditioning?
I think they were. I know "Broadway Baby" was.
Yeah.
Because I knew I played the piano. I knew it was easy enough to play. It had a nice Broadway 2/4, nice groove to it. And I would always get excited while singing it.
That's amazing.
And I guess "I've Confessed to the Breeze." I'm not sure why I chose that, but.
It's a good song.
You love your No No Nanette.
I do.
I love No No Nanette. It's underrated. Well, I hate to say underrated, but it's a hilarious and extremely tuneful musical.
It is underrated. I want to see more productions of it. I really like the show. I like the show. Born in Japan?
Yes.
What circumstances led to the birth in Japan?
Tachikawa, Japan, which is, I think, roughly 15 miles west of Tokyo.
Okay.
My father was served 2 years in the Air Force.
Wow.
I guess, 54 to 56 or 55 to 57. And my mother and my two older siblings went along, and I was born there.
Okay.
And my younger sister was also born in Tachikawa.
How long were you in Japan for?
I think we were there 2 to 3 years.
And then?
Then came back. Then he was done with his military service, and we came back to the States.
The Midwest.
We're in the States. I'm so sorry. Were you?
No, I was going to say the Midwest.
Huh?
Is it true?
Yeah.
Marion.
Very good. Yeah, they ended up in a roundabout way through several cities in the States in Marion, Indiana.
Marion, Indiana.
Birthplace of James Dean, that's about all I can give you.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And home to Jim Walton, for many years.
Yes.
So living in Indiana, how did you discover theater?
I went to Ohio. No. we had quite a theater community in my hometown. A very passionate community of actors. And my first and most important mentor was named Richie Walton. No relation.
Huh. Richie Walton was your first.
He was my church choir director. He directed the choirs at Marion High School and directed the shows, conducted the orchestras, taught music theory. He was kind of like a god when I was like 8 or 10 years old. He was it.
You sound like the town musician theater person.
Yes,
in a way,
he was. Yeah, he was the king at the time, and also a family friend because we were all in the church choir, and he lived a half a mile from. It was a small town.
Yeah.
So he gave me my start, and I took music theory with him, and then I could apply everything I'd learned in piano lessons. Oh. That's a deceptive cadence. Oh, I get it. Oh, well, that's a Picardy third. You know, he taught me all that, and but he was the king of it. But there were a lot of people who loved the theater, and he would come to New York City every summer and see 8 to 10 musicals in a week's time.
Oh, wow!
And then come back and somehow would be able to transcribe a song from a Broadway show off of the album, and then voice it for all of us, and we would sing it in a swing choir. You know. And stage, he was...
That's really cool.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
I love teachers that can influence so many students that. One person can really have such an impact.
No, his passion radiated. And he was a disciplinarian as well. Oh, you know, we all had to have our hair cut. I still have my hair kind of cut short like that. It was he was a real clean cut.
Like wholesome, all-American.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Were your parents supportive of you going into the...
They were.
Yeah?
They loved the theater, and that's when I first saw musical theater. They went to see his productions at the high school, and so I was a kid watching these people have the time of their lives on stage.
Do you remember any musical specifically you saw?
Oh, sure. Music Man was a big one. To play Harold Hill, which later happened for me, was a huge motivator. Shows like Half a Sixpence.
Yes.
George M.
It's in London again right now, actually.
Yeah. My Fair Lady.
The big ones. That's great. And then did you immediately go to college after that? Or high school right into college?
Mm-hmm, I did. I went to the University of Cincinnati, conservatory.
What did you study there?
Musical theater.
They had their degree at that point.
A fine arts degree in musical theater, which means it's that goulash of singing, dancing, acting, theater history, development of drama, you know.
Everything.
True. No, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And what roles were you playing when you were in college?
The first role I played, oddly enough, was Dick and James at Sea, Broadway Baby. They had, in Cincinnati, it's no longer operating, the Showboat Majestic, which was an old showboat.
Yeah.
It seated, I don't know, I may be wrong, 100 seats, maybe 150, and it was on the Ohio River. And little stage that would rock when bigger boats would go by. It was like...
Amazing.
Yeah, really. but then I went and worked summer stock at what's still operating called the Wagon Wheel Playhouse in Warsaw, Indiana.
Yeah.
In the round, and I did many roles there. And, but in Cincinnati, I played like the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz, Thomas Jefferson in 1776.
Oh, yeah.
Jerry in Sugar, the Jack Lemmon role. And
back when people still did Sugar.
Yes. Which they should be doing more of.
They should. That's a great show, too.
Yeah. Fantastic score.
Yeah. It works very well.
Were you collecting all the original cast recordings and stuff?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Was there one that got played in your house more than any other?
Well, I can't really say. We played so many of them back when you had, the LP player. You could stack 5 long play,
Yeah.
So you would hear all of Act 1 of Promises, Promises, Roar of the Grease Band, George M., Applause.
Wait, I'm sorry to interrupt. So the record player would you wouldn't have to get up and change the record?
No, if you could stack them back then, so it would like drop one, it would play that whole thing, then the arm would come out, and then the next one would drop down, and it would play that.
And then you'd have to flip for Act 2.
You'd have to flip them,
but you could still have this.
Which is pretty cool.
Unless you had 2 recordings of Applause, then you could do Act 1, and then Act 2.
And just have that waiting.
I didn't quite have that kind of money.
No, they're pricey.
Flash around.
They're still pricey.
But you shared this love of theater with your brother, too.
And my older sister, Joan.
Okay.
And, there's 5 of us, so we all loved the theater.
So we know that Bob gets into the theater as well. Does Joan...
She also studied musical theater, but ended up, she's a freelance choreographer and dance teacher in the Bay Area of California.
That's so cool.
And still doing it.
And your other 2 siblings?
They're not. They don't work in the theater. They're in Indiana doing other jobs, but we all were theater enthusiasts as children. And
some of the biggest lessons you took away from doing summer stock?
It's really, I'll start very generally and try to figure it out, but to be on stage, you know, the experience of playing a part is, for me, the best education. It was the best education because that's where I learned to do whatever, to develop a technique, for better or worse, good habits and bad habits. I suppose it's good in that it teaches you to work fast. You have to learn a role quickly. It was 2 week stock at Wagon Wheel.
Yeah.
So you would open a show and then you'd be learning your next show sometimes while you're rehearsing the show you're rehearsing. But then you have to stage it very quickly. So you kind of have to work fast. I don't remember. There were too many specifics. You'd learn lots of dance steps you never thought you'd learn because the choreographer comes in and says, have you ever done a barrel turn? No. Well, here it is. No, wow. Keep your head up. No, oh, your shoulders have to. Oh, I. So yeah. It's a class.
But you feel that's the best training, would you say to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
In many ways, it was the best training. I was lucky enough that I could go to college and study it, but equally as lucky to work every summer of my college years. I worked at Wagon Wheel Playhouse.
Amazing.
And played as many as three roles a summer. You know, boy, yeah, to have a dozen roles great. Under
I your
mean, belt.
Your resume is like, yeah, by yeah. the end of that the college time experience.
Came,
yeah.
By the time I came to New York, yeah. I had already gained a lot of experience, and I was 23, you know, by then.
So you graduate, and then it's God bless, pound
Pretty
the
much.
Pavement.
Go to New York.
Good luck, have fun.
And did you go straight to New York from graduation?
No, I didn't. I took a job. I wanted to get my equity card. Because after doing 4 or 5 years of non-equity stock, and
of course.
I didn't want to move to New York, I just thought, well, I'm going to go there, and I'm just going to compete on the union level was my ideal. So I went to Naples, Florida, where I was a musical director.
See?
In
wow.
What was then called Naples Dinner Theater, uh-huh. No longer in operation. But it was an equity theater.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I thought, well, if I do a few shows, and I knew the director, maybe they'll throw me a bone and let me be in a play and get my equity card, and that's exactly what happened. So I was there off and on for a year and a half after college.
So let me ask you, because you did it a while ago, you don't do it anymore, but music directing, what makes a good music director? You've worked with so many in your career.
Wow. Well, I guess there's a lot. Just being a good leader, whatever that means, which is, you know, pushing your singers and your choir, your singing ensemble to be as good as they could be without being too much of a pain.
Yeah.
You know? Things like diction, you know, as you both, I'm sure, know, when you get a larger group of people singing diction, it's harder to understand the lyrics, and so you really have to be very particular about the vowel you're singing and when you cut off. And I suppose there's a lot to it.
But you must be a music director's dream coming in from that world, so I'm sure you're keeping an eye out on yourself as well.
I suppose so. Once in a while, I've said, we're in B major here, so I think it's an A sharp. Oh, right.
Sometimes it can be a curse, because you're like, I don't want to know more than they do.
Yeah.
A curse and a blessing.
Sometimes if it's in the voice, I go, ooh, I think it's an A sharp. Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, yes, sorry. You know.
Did you play a lot for people in college? I mean, were you accompanying for people and stuff?
Yeah. I studied when I was a kid, and then when I was around 14 or 15, I started playing theater music, which really resonated with me more.
Same.
Might be a difficult question, but who was your favorite composer to play?
Ooh, boy. I don't know. Growing up?
Yeah.
Like, at all?
Who did you enjoy playing?
Oh, you know, like Haydn. I still enjoy playing Haydn.
Yeah.
Like, sonatas, they're challenging, but they're just not quite as hard as Mozart to me. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They're very similar. I don't know. I like playing Bach. I mean, I know it's crazy. I like the real.
You like the?
The real classic Chopin,
yeah.
Bach, Mozart, Haydn.
Nice.
But then when I got into theater music, all of them. Yeah. Cole Porter, Gershwin, I don't know.
How fun.
And then once I started trying to play Sondheim, then it was much more challenging.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what show you were music directing when you went down to Naples? Was it a whole bunch of stuff that you were doing?
I did a few shows. I think the first show that I did was I know I did Fiddler, Sound of Music, Irma LaDuce.
Irma LaDuce.
Was wow. The first show I musical directed there.
Oh, my gosh.
And I,
what
I
a way to start you off.
Oh, my gosh.
An odd show.
It's a bit weird.
Yeah, I don't really know it. And even now, I don't have a recording of it.
I think you're okay. I think you're okay. And then you got your equity card down there, too?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was in room service. They did, you know, the
oh
old,
my gosh.
That the Marx Brothers did a version of in a film. Room service. It's like a drawing room comedy. Takes place in a hotel. And
that got you the equity card and then back to New York City?
Yeah, I did a musical directed again there after that, a Cole Porter review, as I recall. Mm-hmm.
Perfect, 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 perfect.
Yeah, and then I moved to New York in February of 79.
What was auditioning for musical theater like in 1979 as compared to now?
Boy, I don't know. I don't audition as much as I used to.
Of course.
Not because I'm getting offers. It's just there are fewer parts. And
sure.
It's different. As like I said earlier, we sang entire songs. I remember that. And if you wanted to sing the verse, you could. Yeah. You know, it wasn't like 16 bars didn't exist back then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe it did, but I escaped that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. It was just different to be young and to have your career ahead of you and just.
Were you working without an agent, or did you get an agent at this time?
I worked without an agent for the first, I guess, 6 to 8 months. I just, Backstage was my agent, Backstage Magazine. You'd pick it up every Wednesday, I think it came out, and I'd circle auditions. There were union, and I would go.
That's amazing.
And I started as a musical director for a show called Big Bad Burlesque that was at the Orpheum Theater.
Yes, we wanted to ask you about.
That was my New York City debut.
Jim Walton's Big Bad Burlesque. So
was it big? Was it bad? And was it burlesque?
Well, it was probably all of those things. It was at the Orpheum Theater now where Stomp's
been there
Stomps
probably since years. Big Bad Burlesque has been exactly. there. I mean,
it was a kind of an affectionate portrait to the days of burlesque. There were the scantily clad young ladies.
Love my, oh my.
It yes, wasn't please. A bad deal for me.
Yeah.
I had many visual cues that I had to watch.
Focus.
What was going on while them. I played. No, I played piano and drums at the same
yes.
time.
What?
I
had a, you I kick did, drum or
see,
something.
I had, yeah, I had a snare drum
yeah.
towards the bass clef and a hi-hat. So I could still operate my sostenuto pedal on the piano and play, but I could do upbeats on the... And then I would pick up the sticks and go on the snare drum because I also played the drums when I was a kid. And that was on my resume, so they...
Killing me.
Yeah, it was... Yeah, I hate to talk badly about it, but it was a crazy time where I was... And I also did arrangements, and it was...
Baptism by fire
when
here.
When you come to New York and you're like, oh, I got to say yes to everything, you know, I got to do it
much.
All, you know.
I was 24.
Yeah.
Or 20. Yeah. I turned 24 when I did that job.
Oh, my God almighty.
And I also tap danced in it because that was on my resume. Right. And I said, well, who's going to play? Nobody. It's going to be a tacit thing where there was a fire pole. I played up on the second story, up, you know, above the others.
Yeah.
But there was to get down to the stage, there was a fireman's pole. So I started act two wearing tap shoes, slid down the fire pole and tap danced with Danny Herman, who was in the show. And then I ran up the stairs and did the rest of the act in my tap shoes at the piano. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty insane.
Now, how does Scrambled Feet come into all of this?
Well, that I auditioned for while doing Big Bad Burlesque. That was already a hit at the top of the gate.
I think I have the record for that, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you tell our listeners what Scrambled Feet was?
It was, in many ways, I think it was the predecessor to Forbidden Broadway.
Mm.
It was a lighthearted comic review aimed at, in part, at parodying the theater. They made fun of Elephant Man and other shows. I can't even remember now. Yeah. But four people were in it. John Driver, Jeffrey Haddo, who wrote it, Roger Nelson, and Evelyn Barron. And a duck was in it, a live duck.
Which is on the cover of the album.
Yes, what is this duck that I hear? It was an actual live duck on stage.
It was.
Wait, what?
Yeah, yeah, that's...
Yeah, absolutely.
I missed that part
Evelyn
of my life.
Barron, the one female in the show, started it. I think it was in Act Two. She sat down at the piano, and everybody accompanied themselves on the piano. There was no band. You accompanied each other or yourself. Yeah. She started singing... I think it was like, Un Bel Di. She started singing an operatic thing, Un Bel Di, and then a duck comes out from behind the curtain, quack, 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 and the audience laughs, and she stops, and then she sings a song called Never Go On Stage With an Animal.
Oh, cute.
Perfect. And that's what it is. And
duck was also an Ermola Deuce.
Yeah.
Ducks had a very nice career since.
Some very good work.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work for one song. Yes, it's amazing. I love it. I mean,
it was odd. And the duck was kind of aggressive because we had. No, we had to walk from our dressing rooms downstairs through the kitchen to the back of the... We'd entered along this back wall in the theater. But the duck would chase at you and bite your legs. Would bite at your legs.
Because he wanted to be in Pippin again. That's
the duck wanted to be in Pippin.
That's not a duck, dummy. That's not a duck.
That is hysterical.
Wow.
No, so you were part of the replacement cast for Scream?
Yes, uh-huh.
Who else, was it just you replacing, or was there a group of people coming in with you?
A group of people. Mitch Greenberg, who's... presently in Fiddler on the Roof, Steve Liebman, who's no longer with us, sadly, myself, and Faith Prince went in. We went to college together, so she came in part to see me in Scrambled Feet, stayed for a Q&A, and asked how she could get an audition, and they set it up, and then she replaced Evelyn Barron later, or maybe it was Susan Edwards, whoever replaced Evelyn.
But, yeah.
Oh, how fun.
But it was good. I must have done it for a year and a half and played piano and sang. I was kind of like the young leading man guy. I sang the one ballad about being in love with my girlfriend, and She Gives Me More Than Love was the song.
Oh, how sweet. How inappropriate, but
I was
going
to say, in this day and age, everyone's mind
was an STD.
Go,
yeah, okay, she gave me more than love, and there's an ointment
and
for
a duck.
Yeah.
Well,
oh my gosh! God. So I think that's going to take us to Perfectly Frank.
Oh my!
The Frank Lesser.
One of the lesser shows on Broadway that season.
Yeah.
I didn't make that up. I thought it was a great show. Yeah, that was my Broadway debut in November of 1980.
How does your Broadway debut come about? Audition?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah?
I auditioned. Ron Field was directing, choreographing, and Tony Stevens ended up basically choreographing most of it. But I knew who Ron Field was, mainly from Applause, and I was a huge Applause fan.
Yeah.
Which was the first Broadway show I ever saw.
Oh, Applause was the first Broadway show you ever saw. Okay.
Wow.
My father brought my older sister Joan and me into the city because... his relatives and my mother's relatives' families were from the Northeast, so we would come to New York basically every summer. So I knew who Ron Field was, and so I auditioned. I don't remember what I sang, but I got a call back, and I do remember.
Oh, here, yep.
I
he's
think
got
I,
you.
Do you know this?
No, but I saw the glint in your eye, and I got excited.
Well, I think this is what got me the job, because there was required... for this role, I was to play the piano and sing something like a piano bar sort of situation in one of the sketches in Perfectly Frank, which never came to be. But I thought, well, what am I going to sing? And I thought, well, I'm not going to sing Frank Lesser. That's too easy. And I decided, I don't know how I got this idea, that I was going to say, I want to sing a couple of songs that Barbara Streisand made famous. I'm going to sing a medley of On a Clear Day and People. And then I started a medley.
A medley.
Sing them at the same time. And okay. And then I played and I sang, oh, people, people who need people are the luckiest people in the world. Meaning I sang the lyrics to People Clear Day.
Amazing.
Which was hard to do. And then the sentences would end on a phrase
risky.
In the middle of... Yeah, it was totally
Jim
stupid.
Walton for the win.
Yeah, but they laughed, and I think that's probably in part what did it.
Because
it was really
that's
moronic.
So out there. I mean, picture it. I mean, like your first Broadway show. I mean, like, you know, it's a Broadway show. You got a callback and you're like, I'm going to do my own thing, actually.
Pretty much. Well, it was Steve Martin was a big a hero of mine at the time.
Oh,
it
yeah?
seemed like something he would do. Like, they asked me to sing two songs totally. At the same time. Can you believe it? I'm going to do it. Here goes. You know,
that's true. It's
so Perfectly Frank was a Frank Lesser mm-hmm. review.
Yes.
And then he wrote.
I believe so.
Okay.
And yeah. yes, Joe okay. Sullivan Lesser, his widow, yeah. was in it. And she was kind of the, I guess, the narrator.
Right.
Mm-hmm. For, mm-hmm. Although everyone, I think, said things here and there. I know there were lines that we had in sketches and a lot of songs. And
so there were sketches?
There were sketches.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But mainly songs.
Mainly the music of Frank Lesser.
Yes.
What songs did you sing? Do you remember what was on your
I
track?
Remember saying, saying Never Will I Marry.
It's a tough song.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Huge skip. I mean,
yeah. Marry.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm.
I know I sang Baby It's Cold Outside with Virginia Sandifer.
Oh.
And it wasn't, well, it was Christmas time. Well,
but,
we also ran yeah. 2 weeks. But, and I'm really having trouble remembering, oh, no. Rosanna, Rosanna, the wind knows your name. I don't even know the song anymore, and people don't know it. It was from a movie.
Okay.
Oh,
he wrote
okay.
a lot of movie songs, uh-huh. yeah.
That's great, though.
Yeah.
That's a fun track.
Was yeah. it a big cast? I mean,
it was 10.
Oh, gosh. That is bigger than
five.
I thought.
Yeah.
It was more than just four, yeah.
Nope, it was 10.
Oh, my. And, but only 2 weeks, and then
two
it was
weeks,
like...
That was it.
But
the old Helen Hayes, which is now the Marriott...
Marquis.
Lobby. Yeah.
It's lobby. Yes. Yeah, yes. It's a lobby. So now, how does Merrily come into your orbit?
Well, I auditioned for that while I was doing Perfectly Frank.
Oh, okay.
Was Joanna Merlin casting yeah. it?
I mean, she cast yeah, Merrily. Yeah. I don't think she cast Perfectly
no.
Frank.
She just worked for
yeah,
yeah,
Prince.
Al Prince.
Yeah.
And I went to the audition for her, which was, I believe, at King Studios, which is no longer there. It's on 43rd between 10th and 11th.
Oh.
I think it was in the Armory building.
Okay.
Do you know the
yeah.
Armory on 42nd?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was there or near, okay. very nearby. And I just wanted to get a call back so I could meet Hal Prince and Steve. That's all
totally.
I wanted.
Yeah.
I got a call back. And that was at the Minskoff that fateful day, early December mm-hmm. of 1980.
80.
Yes.
And I have to, well, tell our listeners, we've talked about this before, but the documentary, The Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened, that's a brilliant documentary that documents so much of this process. But we'd love to hear more about it from your side. So what was this rehearsal process like, working with the titans of theater, making their next big hit?
Well, I don't know. I guess overall, looking back, I would say that we were all, of course, enamored of Prince and Sondheim. They were huge then. I mean, there was nobody like them.
Really quickly, going into the room with people like that who had such a massive reputation, does that cripple you in any way whatsoever in terms of your artistic choices? Do you feel intimidated or?
Well, now I do. But that back then when I was 20, I auditioned when I was 25, and by the time I was rehearsing, I was 26.
Hmm.
It was kind of cocky, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you're probably one of the oldest ones.
I was.
You're the old, yeah.
yeah.
You know what
I mean?
25.
And I'd done a Broadway show.
You're a
yes,
veteran.
Totally.
Yeah. And I wasn't, you know, arrogant or anything. It wasn't that. It was more to, I think I had an overly confident demeanor to protect my own vulnerabilities that I wasn't yet
well
capable of processing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this is when you were not playing Frank. I mean, you
yeah,
were...
Yeah, I was his lawyer, Jerome.
His lawyer, Jerome.
Originally,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah.
So I think it pretty much was well-behaved and worked hard and sang out and... Yeah, I don't really remember except that we were all just knocked out, that we were cast, and it was unbelievable even then.
Did the cast get along very well?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah,
everybody, to my recollection, got on very well, and Hal Prince was so respectful and kind to us, and so was Steve, and it was almost like I felt like we were all 30-year veterans working with them. They treated
right.
us like real professionals.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. Cause
what makes Hal Prince such a great director? Speaking from an acting point of view, what makes him such a great director?
Well, his knowledge, of course, he has done so much and had learned so much. But I think it's also his spirit, a sort of a real positive, almost like a boyish spirit, the fun of theater. It's exciting. Whatever he's working on, he seemed to be excited by it, mm-hmm. and just couldn't wait to share it with his cast.
So, it's contagious.
Yeah, yeah, it's more that it's a joyful passion for the theater. I think that's the main ingredient. That's he has it more than I do. I mean, I meet these people and think, boy, he's not kidding. He really is that passionate and excited and positive. Oh, okay.
How sweet.
Yeah.
In the rehearsal room, did you feel like you had a hit on your hands?
I guess so. I remember just taking it for granted, that if more than anything. I thought, well, of course.
Well, yeah, they just did Sweeney Todd.
And these men wrote Company.
Yeah.
Were you asked to understudy Frank originally?
No, I was not Frank's understudy.
Got it.
No, I think David Cady was. I believe I was just his lawyer, Jerome, and a little ensemble thing.
Yeah.
I was in the transitions, and
of course,
but no, I wasn't his understudy.
But then, in previews, correct?
Yes. Well, it was around the time Ron Field.
Yeah, back again.
Yeah,
going back to Ron Field,
who was the original choreographer. Who, as a footnote, I wouldn't be surprised if his participation is in large part why I was cast at all. This is just me speculating.
Yeah.
But it's like, well, not that I didn't have the skills, but he liked me. I knew he liked me. But anyway, the day that he was fired, quit, whatever happened, he told me that was to be so, and I told him I was sorry to hear it, and he said, and by the way, Hal's going to want to talk to you today. And I thought, oh, great, I'm going to be fired. I thought I was going to be fired or demoted or something. And then I went to the lower lobby of the Simon Theater, and he told me in so many words there were some problems with the show, and the producing team wanted to see someone else as Frank Shepherd. And he said, though, I'm happy with it. He says, I like what James Weisenbach is doing. You know, I'm not the only...
Sure.
I don't have the only say here, so.
And did they want you to audition, or were they just like, learn it? Just learn the material? I mean, because I don't know how many features you had in it as his lawyer, Jerome. But, I mean, from that to, you know what I mean, though? And then all of a sudden they're like, hey, and put this on your shoulders for a little bit. Just learn the part and see what happens.
Pretty much what it was. They said, we'll give you, I think it was 4 days to learn it, and then we'll let you go on for 2 performances, just in case you're a little jittery the first night. Who wouldn't be?
Sure.
Just give you 2 shots at it, and then we'll make a decision. No matter what, you'll either have the part or you'll still be Jerome. So it's a win-win.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why not do
I
the
said,
work?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Sure. Why not?
Was the other actor aware of this? Or was
oh
this
yeah,
a,
he was okay. told too. It was a little uncomfortable for me.
Yeah. I was going to say. Yeah.
It probably was for him too, but. Yeah. It was odd because we had scenes together as Jerome and Frank, and I'm watching it going, oh, he crosses to stage left 4. You know?
It's weird. Totally.
It's that like, running monologue in your mind.
Or like I'm going over his words and mine. It's like, mm-hmm. It was an odd.
How surreal.
It was surreal. It was an odd time.
So at what point did they make the decision that you were going to play Franklin Shepherd?
I was told after the first night.
Oh.
When I did it, I went on. I remember they were there in the wings, stage left, and it was
they
like,
being,
I guess Hal, Prince, maybe Steve Sondheim. I don't remember if Steve was there, but I remember Hal just said, "It's yours."
That like, night while you were getting off.
Wow! But I was still in costume.
Holy crap!
Oh my God!
Still in my t-shirt and carpenter pants.
Totally. The old t-shirt and carpenter pants combo.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's the way I remember it.
That's what you remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's once again beautifully documented.
Oh, Lonnie Price. Jeez. Yeah, it's beautiful.
We talked about it on a few episodes ago, and it really is just a majestic, majestic documentary. I think it's the best documentary about theater
I think
ever
so
made,
special.
Period.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of the best. I mean, it's hard to...
Yeah.
To say which one people like, the Pennybacker.
Oh, the company, one. Yeah.
Oh, which is, that's good,
but
too.
It's,
but
it
it's
doesn't
different.
Have the emotional.
No. This has a heart.
And when you have the, also the history included in it, that's what's magical.
Thank God there's a cast recording of this. That this was preserved.
Absolutely.
I mean,
and can you tell us, when did you record that recording?
We recorded it the day after we closed. I think it was November 29th. Of 81 was when we recorded it. So, you know, the day after we closed.
And did you get, how much closing notice did you have? I mean, was the writing on the wall for a while? Did we kind of know that it wasn't, we know in previews that they were tweaking and they were constantly working on it, but.
I think the writing was indeed on the wall. Yeah. They gave us 1 week notice. So I don't know if that means they had to pay us another week. I don't remember how, I don't even know. Yeah. I should know, but. Mm-hmm. I believe they gave us 1 week notice because we opened and the reviews came out, which were pretty devastating, but it was already too late to give 2 weeks because, you know, we would have run 3 weeks that way because we were already into that week, the first week. But we, I think we had 1 week notice, and also we had about 1 week notice for we would indeed be recording the cast recording because for a while we heard that it was not going to happen.
Wow.
But then it came to be that it was recorded, and it was the morning after. We showed up at 10 a.m. the next day, and I remember it was a long day. I didn't leave.
Bittersweet.
Oh, yeah. Very much. Gosh. So. And I didn't leave till 2 a.m. the next morning.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was 12 plus, 16 hours, I guess.
Wow.
And that was the final goodbye.
That was it.
Yeah.
It was the very last time we were all. Yeah.
Isn't that wild?
Together.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty wild.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And you also got married during this time, is that right?
Yeah, you know, I had some free time.
Between
shows. So I got the 2 hours and 45 minutes. I'll just keep my microphone on. And let's go to City Hall. Well, that's a long, a lot of people don't. Well, now they know, but yes, the day, these are the footnotes, the bullet points. The day after we opened, my girlfriend, Janie Gleason, told me she was pregnant.
Okay.
So I read the reviews. No, I didn't read the reviews, by the way. I by then I was already thinking, just don't read them.
Yeah.
But I knew.
Yeah.
You could just smell it in the air, the way people talk to you. And well, anyway, she told me that she was pregnant, and that was November 17th. So then we were married exactly 10 days later at City Hall.
Oh, wow.
So the first few days was like, well, what are we going to do? What do you want to do? What am I prepared to do? I don't, so it was also me going, boy, this is some crazy timing. I'll bet we're going to close the show before the new year. I wish I could make a major life decision when I'm not distracted by one of the, perhaps the biggest
That's intense.
Work, career, opportunity.
Yeah.
So it was.
And life event in itself. Yeah.
So
you know?
My worlds collided, to say the least. It was like mid November of 1981 was like dizzying.
And you had a beautiful baby.
I have a beautiful daughter named Tyler. She lives in Palo Alto, California.
Lovely. Oh,
wow. You can do the math. I'm not going to tell you how old she is because you don't talk about that. But she saw the documentary 2 days ago, and said she wept through the second half
of it. I can't imagine if I got to see my father like, and like as... You know, when my age now, you know, you know what I mean? Yeah. Or at least close to it.
Sure. Yeah. I'm not in a lot of that early footage. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, you can see me here and there. And I think, oh my God, I was so good looking.
Why was I so insecure? What's it like watching yourself from 1980, 81?
It's odd because I just think, oh my God, we were all so cute. Mm. We were all so attractive. You know, youth has its own allure.
True.
Even an ugly 20-year-old is kind of good looking.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's a. I don't want to see you in 20 years, pal. But it was interesting to watch. And
was it hard at all when you watched it?
Oh yeah, it was. I don't really like watching myself the interviews of the present day interviews. Mm-hmm. It was like I wanted to say smile. You know, I look just a little. I looked a little world-weary and serious, which is fine. There's that part of me, too. But
sure. Well, you were 25. You were an old pro at that point, so that's where the world-weariness comes from.
Oh, no,
from,
not when I was 25. I looked I looked cute and fine then, but I'm talking about the
present
footage.
Day.
The present-day footage was a little
please.
Like, oh, well, you know.
You look so charming.
Oh, that's very kind.
Now, I want to jump back to somebody who has done so much for musical theater. I don't think he gets the credit he deserves, and that's Ron Field.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Who does so much work, and we, for some reason, he's just sort of forgotten in our. We've talked about him.
We talked to Leroy. We talked to other people have worked with him, but yet I feel like younger people have no idea.
They know Bennett and they know Gower Champion.
Yeah, sure.
They just sort of forget Ron Field.
Yeah.
So what was he like? What was his work ethic like? What was he like as a person? Why should we remember him?
Well, his credits, you know them probably far better than I. He never really did have a chorus line or Dream Girls, in my opinion.
I agree. Applause was as close, I think, as you
and
got.
And the original choreographer for Cabaret, but not directing Cabaret.
Yeah, he did Liza's, a lot of Liza's shows, probably Liza with a Z or whatever those. I don't know. He was kind of snarky and funny to me, almost like a dancing Paul Lynde. We always used to do Paul Lynde impressions. You know what I mean?
That's a good one.
We love that on this podcast.
But, you know, I think he kind of encouraged my snarkiness or my smart alecky side.
Amazing.
You guys would do Paul Lynde impersonations together?
Well, as I remember.
that is the best Paul Lynde I've ever heard.
He's doing the face. I wish you could guys see.
Oh, this is so wonderful. I loved him.
When we do the Paul Lynde story, we will cast Jim Walton.
Oh my God! We love Paul Lynde.
Yes, he comes up on this podcast. Oh my God. I used to do impersonations of him so much that it crept into my own delivery on stage, and I worked with the director who said, "It's like you're doing a Paul Lynde impression." And went, "I can." And then I would break into it. And then he would go, no, don't do that.
It's the like, strangest production of Miracle Worker anybody had ever seen.
I want you to. Like.
Oh, my God. Mine is nothing like Jim's.
Well,
Jim's is brilliant. My God.
I've studied it, too. I mean, I've like once in a while, I've just watched him in Hollywood Square. Anyway, enough about that. But no,
my day is made. Yeah.
No, but Ron encouraged me. I think he just liked me, and he encouraged me, and you know, I could dance. I was more of a tap dancer than anything, but I could make my way through a dance routine as well as any of the singers could. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I think he respected me for that, and so, but. He was a funny, complicated. He was complicated, and I think he had his own share of bitterness about life or the business. And I can understand that. I don't know the details of that, but that's partly what made him very funny. He kind of had a wicked sense of humor.
Yeah.
I dreamed a dream of days to come where sponsorship is high and money is forthcoming.
That's beautiful, Kevin.
No, I really added a voice onto that one, too. I really was trying to go for something there.
Listeners, we love creating this podcast, but it does cost money. Please don't make me sell my Angel record.
Oh, my gosh. The original cast recording of Angel.
That, like, nobody has.
Nobody has it.
If you like what we are doing and want us to keep doing more of it, please head over to Patreon.com.
What?
That's Patreon.com.
Patreon.
Patreon.
Yeah,
Patreon.
Rion.
Patreon.
Yeah, and once you're there, search for Behind the Curtain Broadway's Living Legends. And of course, we don't expect to give without receiving some great rewards.
Such rewards include behind-the-scenes videos, shout-outs on future episodes, or episodes, depending on what part of the country you're from, because I said episodes, and early access to some of our podcasts. Hell, for the right price, Kevin and I will come to your apartment and act out all of Agnes of God.
So head over, friends, to patreon.com to help us out.
One of the things that you did, which we find so fascinating, is this Follies in Concert, which I know was just a couple of days of rehearsal, so I'm sure it felt like a whirlwind for you. But do you have any specific memories of working with those legends and putting this amazing score together?
Oh, it was phenomenal. It was a week. It was the first week of September of 1985. Mm-hmm. And I was out on the road with 42nd Street at the time.
Yes. Yeah, yes, yes, yes.
But I got enough advance warning and the offer that I got to do it, that I took my vacation that week. So amazing. I got paid by 42nd Street.
Right.
And
to
Lincoln
go
Center.
Do that. Yeah.
Wow.
Not a bad deal.
No.
So I came to New York, and we rehearsed for like 4 or 5, I think it was 4 days.
Yeah, which was documented on that
great documentary.
Amazing
documentary.
Yeah.
Well, it was phenomenal. I mean, again, it was... It was like Merrily in that, how the heck did I get this? Well, because Sondheim handpicked us, you know. And three of us were in Merrily, Daisy Prince, Liz Calloway, myself, and then Howard McGillin was the other, the young Ben. It was thrilling to work with all these people.
Yeah.
I was on stage with Lee Remick and, you know, that I talked to Carol Burnett, and Barbara Cook was so nice. Yeah, it's just an amazing group of people.
Yeah.
So I want to jump back for a second. So you said you were on tour with 42nd Street. So you have the wife and a young daughter at this. How do you make that work?
Well, by that point, I was already divorced.
You were divorced.
By 1985, I was. But originally, Janie and Tyler and I went to Chicago when Tyler was 4 months old, which is where I began work on 42nd Street.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And so we took the train. We took the train from New York to, it was easier, we thought, with the baby and all this luggage to take the train.
So did you open the show in Chicago?
Mm-hmm.
And then was the idea that Janie and...
No, we stayed on the road. Then we played 3 months in Chicago. Then we went to Las Vegas.
Wow.
For 2 or 3 months at the Caesar's Palace. And... it closed a little early there. Didn't do as well as they'd expected or wanted. And Janie, by that point, said, I'm tired of the road.
I'm out of here.
And she was just, you know, along for the ride.
Yeah.
She wasn't in the show. She didn't work on it. So she settled in Burbank, California, because she had friends there.
Yeah.
We settled there, but it was a long story short. They declared a hiatus on 42nd Street for 3 months so they could close down that company and reopen it in Philadelphia 3 months later. I think they had to wait 3 months or 10 weeks or whatever it was before they could reopen with the same cast, whatever. So we spent that a couple of months in Burbank. And then I went back out alone on the road to Philadelphia, which is kind of where the marriage really... Because I decided to get into trouble that way. I was, you know, no one to mind the shop, so.
Yeah.
But anyway, then skipping forward, then after we divorced basically in the autumn of 84, a year later I was in New York doing the Follies in Concert. Yeah.
And New York's been home for you ever since.
No, since February of 79.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, I'm living in the same apartment I found in March of 1979. It's been stabilized.
You and George Lee Andrews.
Yeah, exactly.
That's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it's, and I took it not knowing it was even rent stabilized. I thought, oh, $280 a month, that's not bad. That's what it was then.
You're kidding me.
So I thought, well, okay, $400 a month was my top then. I was thinking, I'm not going to pay more than $400 a month. And but that was yeah, a lot then.
That, of course.
No, yeah, yeah.
Of course.
So $280. Gosh. And then they said, you want to be the super? I said, see. And
we'll pay you to live here. It's,
yeah, pretty much. It was free for the first year.
Did you like life on the road?
I did and I didn't. I went back out on the road. In 85, I was out playing like 85 cities in a year and a half across the United States. Ooh. Started in San Francisco and just went all over bus and truck.
That's shorter runs than not 3 months in a place.
No, 3 days sometimes.
That's a lot. That's way more tedious.
Jeez. Very tedious.
Yeah.
And I remember getting to a few cities late enough there where I thought, well, after 10 hours on the bus, I can either check into the hotel and take a shower, or I could eat a good hot meal and then just go to the theater and just do the show.
Wow.
And usually I would just choose to eat
the meal one out.
Because, you know, Billy, you got to dance and jump around and sing high. And
yeah, you need some stamina.
It's a very, it's a very aerobic part.
It is. It's kind of like the most active semi-thankless role I've ever played. You know,
I agree. Like, he's the guy who dances, but, like, it's usually you're like, it's about Peggy.
Yeah.
And, like, really, and Julie Marsh. Yeah. But
he doesn't. Yeah. Anyway, it was a good show for me in many ways. But
did Stardust bring you back to New York City?
Basically, the tour of 42nd Street closed on the road, I think, in 1986. And I just came home.
Yeah.
And then, but I think Stardust was shortly after that. It was downtown at a place called Theater Off Park.
But I never heard of that.
Theater Off Park.
I don't think it exists anymore. It used to be off of Park Avenue or off of Central Park, but then it moved to a place in the Village where there's no park. And it was like, well, there are parks, but it was not near a park.
But it wasn't like,
it's like, right. Why is it called Theater Off Park? Well, that's park what it's called uptown. It's like, way off park. Should be Theater Way Off Park.
off park, yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, we did it. Six people? Yes, 3 men, 3 women. And it was a big enough hit there in that 99-seat theater that Louise Westergaard and others, producers, said, we're going to Broadway. But even then, I thought, really? You're taking this little review to... Back then, already, I was at age 31. I was thinking, this shouldn't go to Broadway.
Who else was in that cast with you?
Andre DeShields, Kim Criswell, Michelle Beautier, Maureen Brennan.
Oh, jeez.
Jason Graw, myself.
And these are the songs of Mitchell Parrish and Hoagy Carmichael?
Well, Mitchell Parrish and various...
And various other...
You know, Hoagy Carmichael, whoever wrote The Sleigh Ride.
Leroy Anderson?
Yes, exactly.
I love Leroy Anderson.
Yeah.
Goldilocks.
Yeah.
My favorite musical.
Yeah.
How did that do?
It did very well off Broadway.
Yes.
You couldn't get a seat.
But and the old classic transfer.
Yeah, and they tried to puff it up.
Yeah.
You know, it just didn't... It didn't work.
It ended up being like a review of songs.
Yeah,
basically.
It was like a sophisticated ladies.
Yeah, yeah.
But a smaller cast.
Sure.
And, you know, we were good, capable singing actors and dancers, but, you know, we weren't Greg Hines and, you know, that was the sophisticated ladies was quite a cast.
Yeah.
And to make it pop and on a Broadway stage, and they're not theater songs.
Yeah, right.
It's really,
it's tricky.
Really
that
difficult.
Is actually, you take for granted those storytelling songs and how important they are for an audience.
Well, you need the depths and the breadth of the stage in order to attach to those characters. And if you're singing Sweet Lorraine, well, that's a lovely song, but it's like, what's the story? You're just happy because you met a girl you like. That's neat.
Yeah, right.
So you did the best you could.
What theater did it play?
The Biltmore, which is now the Friedman.
Yeah.
Oh, right, of course.
It's on 47th and
8th.
Yeah. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
You've done a lot of reviews and a lot of revivals.
That's,
In your time. And now your next revival, this is a big one, this is Sweeney Todd.
Yes.
So, or Teeny Todd.
That's right.
Teeny Todd.
Oh, that's
condensing of
We spoke with a co-star of yours just a couple weeks ago, Eddie Corbett.
Boy,
that's right.
He was maybe the best thing in that. No, he was awesome. Tobias.
He's cool. He's so talented. So sweet. Had you seen the original Sweeney Todd?
Oh yes, twice.
Oh,
yeah. It was the first show I saw in New York City after I moved.
Ooh.
Yeah. I swear, my boxes were still stacked up in my apartment. It was like it's Wednesday afternoon. 1:15 I'm going to TKTS, and I saw it in previews.
Oh, in previews.
I saw it in previews, and then after it opened. Yeah.
Do you think it was just brilliant?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh.
It was pretty much... Well, then again, I think it was the first, sadly, the first Sondheim show I saw on Broadway in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see Company, Follies, Night Music, Pacific Overtures. I didn't live there yet, and...
But Sweeney.
Sweeney I saw, and whoa... Knocked me out.
So when you're here, they're doing it at the York Theater.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first thought that went through your mind?
That's where it started.
Oh yeah, it started at Church of the Heavenly Rest, Fifth Avenue, just east of Fifth, I think.
Yeah.
I don't remember, except I got an audition to play Anthony Hope, and I thought, oh, well, that makes sense. Yeah, and I really don't remember what I thought at first, except I was probably... excited because I love the show so much.
Was there, I don't want this to come out wrong, but was there any sense of hubris at all that you were like, hey, I did Frank and Marilee? Do you know what I mean? A little bit? Like, just a little? Like,
I'm sure there was a little bit like, hey,
I mean, come on, I'm still going to call back.
What I've always wanted to say when I auditioned for Sondheim, I was like, you know, I'm auditioning for Anthony, but by the time you open, I'll be playing Sweeney. So I understand what's going on here. Just wanted to point out the elephant in the room. Yeah. No, I can't do that. No, I think of those things, but then I think, well, that's just ridiculous thought. You know, I know it's an absurd. It doesn't bleed that far. The bragging rights don't bleed that far into actually perpetuating. You know.
But you had done two Sondheim high-profile.
That's true.
Pieces.
Yeah. So I put that in my cap, thinking, "Well, I'm good. I have.
You know the language.
Yes, I have a past and a history with this great artist, and if I'm so lucky, and sure enough, I did it. And then it was a big enough hit, kind of like Stardust. It was a big hit off Broadway, but then the York Theater moved it to Circle in the Square, where it was. I think it was a hit, but it didn't run as long as I felt it should run, you know, and the audience just started getting slimmer.
Yes.
And was it done in a three-quarter thrust, or was it in the round, or was it?
It was kind of in the round.
Yeah.
It was almost environmental. There were scenes in the aisles and all over. It was it was a cool production.
Bob Gunton.
Beth Fowler. Sure, yeah.
I talked to her. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can see, I saw it, as a matter of fact, just because I was researching an idea that I didn't work on. I saw at Lincoln Center Library, Juilliard, you know, the library.
Oh, yeah.
That sits there. You can see it, and it's like, not bad. I think it's quite good.
I was
ready to hate myself, you know what I mean? But I thought, oh, well, it's good. I'm, you know, committed, and I sang well, and all right. Fine.
Yeah.
I'm ready to just hate myself when I say.
Oh my gosh!
You know,
please.
Enough of that.
Did you enjoy performing in such an intimate environment?
I did. Yeah. I think my one regret at the time was that we weren't mic'd. I mean, we didn't wear.
You weren't mic'd,
we did not wear mics on our bodies. There were mics, I think, up.
Wow.
And so there were certain moments where, could you put me near that mic, because it was. I remember it being vocally tiring. Because, keep in mind, if you're not mic'd and you're singing and there are people sitting behind you,
that's
your
tricky
part. Really have to enunciate. And that can really tire out the larynx. And, it's just hard to relax. I remember that. And I remember twice singing to Gretchen Kingsley. I went, let's see if I can do it. I feel you. And she's like, looking at me like twice, it's just like, oh gosh! But you don't want to push too hard on it, you know,
because you got to make it tender.
Yeah.
Like she's right there. That's
tough in that environment.
Classic.
That's really
it's right
tough.
On the mail break too.
If our listeners got a chance to go down to Lincoln Center and take a look at it, it really is stunning.
Sure,
and you are stunning.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Or if you haven't been to Lincoln Center to see anything, go and
do it.
Yeah, because just pick a show. Oh, I wished I'd seen. in, I don't know what.
Say you're doing it for research, and you just go.
Fill in the blank.
And there's everything has been filmed over the last like 30 years.
Yeah, it's fascinating because you really see a lot of detail.
Yeah.
And now going to your next review, and the world goes round.
Ah, finally. A hit.
A hit. Yes. Congratulations,
finally
Jim Walton.
Hit, well, you know, it's kind of true, though. It's really, actually, of all the shows I've done in New York, it's almost the one where I was featured and they built it on us, the five of us.
Tell us about this process, because we love the show, but we're completely so interested to hear how this all comes about.
Well, I think it's the genius of those creators.
Kander and Ebb.
Never mind. Kander and Ebb, but Susan Stroman, Scott Ellis, Tommy Thompson, who was the book writer. I think it's those ideas. That to me is what makes it work. Like Me and My Baby, where we're singing to our little carriages and then we pull out banjos and we're all playing singing to our banjos. I mean, but for review, that's... To me, that's great stuff. And then we all played the banjos.
The staging is impeccable.
Oh, yeah.
Have the staging.
Yeah. I saw a bootleg. But
I have that bootleg.
Okay, great.
Lucky. Yeah. Allegedly.
Really good, yeah. The staging is impeccable.
Oh, yeah.
She's special.
It's you know, not to discredit Scott Ellis, but it's hard to know whose idea is whose.
And that's a great collaboration, isn't
it?
Yes,
right. Yes,
but,
totally.
But what they put together... was genius. But they also worked, like I remember when I auditioned, you know, the special skills down at the bottom. No, I can tap dance. When I was a kid, I played a lot of instruments, just ADD. You know, I played banjo. I played 4-string banjo a little bit and 5-string banjo.
Oh my gosh.
Just because.
Why not?
You're sitting around in Indiana. So, yeah, exactly. And
you love Steve Martin, and he's a major on Bright Stars.
Huge.
One of my favorite
five-star
musicals.
Earl Scruggs, he does the... He's amazing.
He's incredible.
So they saw that. That's partly why we all played banjo. I was like, what?
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah. Anyway, so it was just those... They built the show around our skills and... their own great ideas.
Who were your co-stars in that?
Two Karens, Karen Mason, Karen Ziemba, and Brenda Presley. But she had an injury early on, so Terry Burrell went on for her quite a bit. But Brenda and Bob Cuccioli was the other guy. So it was five of us.
Fantastic.
And David Loud did the arrangements and was the conductor.
Who was primarily with you?
Yep. So you got to build a lot of it in the rehearsal room, though. Is that correct?
It seems to me that I remember it that way. We did it first at the Hole Theater, which was then operating in Montclair, New Jersey.
Oh.
Olympia Dukakis ran the theater.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
It's no longer.
Yeah, not around anymore.
There.
And then from New Jersey to...
I think a year or so later, we got another production of it.
Wow.
But in New Jersey, it was Brent Barrett and I who did it.
Yeah.
And was there a different woman I'm trying to remember? I should remember, but I can't. But then we booked it at the newly renovated West Side Arts Theater, the upstairs room, and rehearsed it, put it up, and we got great reviews and then recorded it. And, you know, it was a... great feather in my cap, and but even by then, I remember opening night. I had one of those moments where I was looking like through a foggy window at my life, thinking, "Wow, it's a hit," and I'm, you know, I have debts from my divorce. You know what I mean? It was like I'd gotten to like a mountaintop, but
it was Kander and Ebb, there's reality too.
Yes.
Were Kander and Ebb around?
Yes, they
and
were.
Can you speak a little bit about Fred Ebb? Because we don't get to chat with him, and
a
huge admirer. We both love his work and who he was.
Absolutely. He was a great guy to us. Again, John and Fred, where they were like, we called them Uncle John and Uncle Fred. They were just these benevolent, loving, you can do no wrong type of guys. You know what I mean? It was weird.
Yes,
like,
totally.
I remember, Fred was just funny and would laugh at you when you would sing Sara Lee. You know, it's like, come on, you know this song.
Right, I know. You still think it's funny?
Right. But I remember I had to play, I played, you know, all that jazz on stage and also part of New York, New York. And I went to John and I said, I have these changes for New York, New York, you know, where I just kind of moderate jazz, you know, things on the tritone. He goes, well, let me hear it. And I did it. He goes, oh, yeah, that's fantastic. Yes, do that. He's like, oh, okay, great.
What and, a you know, great, crazy. Yeah, great environment.
Yeah, and I remember another time we had these reprises of World Goes Round. Mm-hmm. I had to sing like Crossing Stage Quietly before a ballad. I had to sing Somebody Loses and Somebody Wins. Sometimes it kicks in. And then I went, but the planet spins and the world goes round and round was what I would sing. But then during previews or tech, I'm backstage, I went, but the, just to myself, I didn't know my mic was on, but the planet spins and the world goes round and round. And John shouted. I went, oh, no. John Candy.
Heard me. Yeah.
I went, oh, no. And he went, Jim, where are you? Get out here. And I went, hi, sorry. And he goes, no, do that. What was that? I said, oh, it was just a little riff. 6, 5, 3, 2, 1. You know. Da-da-ding-da-ding-da. My bad white boy riff. That's right. As jazzy as I get. And he goes, do it. And now it's on the recording.
It is like, on the recording.
And like every guy who sings it now is like, oh, that's the way it goes.
That's
like,
it.
That's what Jim Walton, the definitive way.
But anyway, that was them. Like, almost like you could do no wrong. That's what they...
Well, collaborate. I mean, they've been like that with when we talked about Scott's World Boys the other day. Same team. They were still creating that kind of art. You know,
that's them.
That's just incredible.
That openness, lovely. That generosity.
Yeah. Loveliest guys.
Was there ever any talk about moving that to Broadway?
I don't remember. That's possible.
Yeah,
but again, I think they were smart.
Yes.
Yeah. They knew this is where it belongs. It's a small, clever as hell review. And it sold out, and you know,
yeah.
So
now one of the things that we love about your career is that you go from leading man to supporting player, back to leading man, back to supporting player. When did that work ethic get instilled in you, or how do you think that work ethic got instilled in you?
You mean I haven't been the leading player in every? Oh, I should check my. Oh, that's what a pink contract means.
That's why there's a difference.
I'm sorry to let you know, Jim. I'm so sorry.
I guess the question was, what's it like to go back and forth between a leading player and a...
Yeah.
Well, it can be, you know, on the ego, it can be a little... I have to process it a little bit, you know.
I just want to say, there's a wonderful story in Jen Tepper's book, The Untold Stories of Broadway, that you tell about being in The Music Man.
Is that where I played Harold one in the afternoon and then Marcellus that night?
Would you? Yes. I mean... Would you tell us about this?
Well, it was so ironic. And here I was, 45 years old, you know, fully grown man. I covered three roles in Music Man: Harold Hill, Marcellus, and Charlie Cowell.
Yeah. Okay.
And I went on for all of those guys. Well, one day, matinee day, a Wednesday or a Saturday, they said, Jim, Craig's out. You're Harold Hill. I went, okay, great. So I went on, Harold Hill, audience loves it. I stepped out of the stage door, everybody, yo, Mr. Walton, can I have a picture? Would you sign this for my son? And, you know, all these, I didn't get home for 15 minutes. You know, I had to deal with all these, happily dealt with all these people who loved the show and loved me. Went home, had dinner, went back to the theater. Craig's back. Oh, that's good. But Max is out. You're going to be Marcellus tonight. I went, oh, wow, this is interesting. Okay.
What a day. You know,
yeah, I'm going to be Marcellus. So I go on. I'm still feeling really good.
Yeah.
Great Marcellus. You know, it's different role, of course. And I get out of costume, put on my civvies, and I head out the stage door, open it like, where's my public? And everybody's looking like past me. I'm invisible. And they're like, oh, Craig, Mr. Bierko, would you sign this for my son? I went, oh, of course, idiot. They love the character, you know.
Yeah.
Not that they don't respect you for your work.
Of course.
But nobody knew that I was Harold that afternoon. Right. It's, you know, but...
Of course. Same thing like when you were Harold Hill, but then you walked two blocks away from the theater.
Nobody knows.
Exactly.
No.
Same kind of like little microcosm of what we do.
But it's such a brilliant story, and thank you for sharing it with
My
us.
Pleasure. I love it because it's so... The irony is very rich. And I was still naive enough to open the door like,
of course.
Well, I guess I'll just go home now.
I think a lot of artists can understand that, actually. Yeah. I think that it's part of our business.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure. I have to ask about, you went on tour with Hello Dolly. Is that right? Is that right?
Very good. You've done your research.
Now, was that with Carol Channing? Or was it with Sally? It was with
Carol. It was with Carol Channing.
What was it like? What was she like? I mean,
very nice to me. Michael DeVries was played Cornelius Hackle on the road on that tour, but he pinched a nerve in his neck.
Okay,
like he hurt himself so badly that he just couldn't go on. Ooh. And so Leroy Reams, the director, called and said, "I don't think you've ever done this before, but could you learn the role in 4 days?" And you know, so I'd never played.
Actually, I have done this before.
Hold on,
as a matter of fact.
Well, I could do it. So I learned Cornelius and joined them in like Columbus or wherever they were. I can't remember now.
Yeah,
that is incredible.
And was Miss Channing? Would you say that she hit her marks? That's how I mean. She had like her show, and that was like the way it. And you had to kind of like fit into that.
Pretty much. Yeah. Well, it would be for any show.
I guess
even
you're right.
If it wasn't Carol Channing.
Yeah.
Well, you got to stand on L7 when you sing It Only Takes a Moment, and then you're going to turn, stage left 7. But no, she was kind to me, and, she did that, all of that. She's welcome to the company. But she was nice, and she was doing her, she sure knew her part by then. But I do recall that one time, right before the song Dancing, she went up. Maybe she realized, this isn't Michael DeVries. It took her a week or something. And I said, Mrs. Levi, I think you were going to tell me about how to lead. What moment? I gave her line. I think you were about to teach me to Flavin. And then she went, yes. You Cornelius. But that's all. But other than that, she was right nice on. To
well,
me.
Well, she's a workhorse. I mean, she was a pro. That's amazing.
I have to ask you, what other impressions do you do, Jim?
I've
done a lot over my days, but I'm not,
one-man show with Jim.
I mean.
I can't. Oh, my favorite story about impressions is this happened years ago. 25 years ago, I thought, I want to prepare a song, an audition piece where I can do impressions.
Great.
I thought, what would it be? I said, a song about identity, about being myself. And I came up with I've Gotta Be Me, whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong.
Yeah.
I've gotta be me, I've gotta be me. And I start singing it, and then I slip into, Lewis, or whatever it is. And then I go, sorry, apologize. And then I slip into another. And then finally, I stop apologizing, and they just, I do about 20 impressions in it. It is in about 3 minutes' time. I haven't sung it in a long time, but
that is a brilliant idea.
Talk about creating your own.
Someone's going to steal that.
Yeah.
Well, Jim please let them. I don't care. I have no qualms. That song has gotten me jobs, and I've sung it more at events where do you have something that's kind of upbeat and funny and. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Amazing.
That's one of my favorite things.
I want to talk about your relationship with Lonnie Price. Because you guys went from being co-stars to the fact that he directs you quite often. You've done the Sondheim birthday concert for him. You've done Company with him. And
absolutely.
Now you're about to go into Sunset Boulevard.
I should preface this that this fella Rob has assisted him as a director.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. Wait a minute.
I'm very lucky. I've gotten to work with Lonnie a few times.
What did you do?
I did his Sweeney with him.
Oh,
and
I loved his Sweeney.
Wasn't that brilliant?
Fantastic.
She was something else.
Emma Thompson, right?
Yeah.
That's
genius.
Genius.
Hey. The nicest person you'd ever want to meet, too.
That's what
you tell. It came through.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah. That's and then we did a Sinatra concert together and worked a little bit on the documentary.
Oh, my God.
Yes, I'm very lucky.
That's
We're both very lucky. We are both very lucky.
Yes, I'm extremely
Tell me a little bit about that collaboration. What makes him such a good director?
Well, again, like Hal Prince, it's probably many things about Lonnie that make him such a good director. I think, namely, again, like Hal, his passion, he's kind of obsessed with the theater. You know what I mean? That's his life. It's it. And he's very knowledgeable, well-read, and also I think, namely, that he's a former actor. He knows how actors feel in the process. you know, how to encourage them and how not to make them feel insecure.
Yeah.
Because we all have our insecurities and we all need to be led and to be given room to experiment. And but Lonnie's that way. He loves it. I'm such an old friend that he just says, well, whatever you want to do there, you know. Or he says, oh, no, it's like when you make fun of so-and-so. Oh, that's what. Oh, I know what you mean.
Right.
Like he knows me. He knows my shtick, or he knows the way I am. So
you guys
well.
Have a shorthand by now, right?
Pretty much.
Let's talk about that company concert.
Ooh.
Woo.
What a cast, right?
What a cast.
Yeah.
So
phenomenal.
It's a phenomenal cast. Now, how did you guys put that together? What I had heard, and this is true, not everybody was in the same room at the same time until pretty much the performance.
That's true.
So
and this is the Lincoln Center.
The Lincoln
that
Center
was preserved. Can you watch it?
Well, it's on DVD.
It's on PBS.
It's commercially available.
Purchase it.
Yeah. Neil Patrick Harris and
yes.
Patti LuPone, Stephen Colbert.
John Cryer. Martha Plimpton. I mean, this is a cast. But nobody in the same room at the same time, pretty much.
That's wild.
I mean, most of us were in the same room. But I think Stephen Colbert, who was doing the Daily Show at the time, was absent a little bit. So they would video things and send it to him, and especially to Neil Patrick Harris, who was in Los Angeles, still shooting How I Met Your Mother, I believe.
Wow.
So they would video us behind us while we're going through the dances so that he could watch our feet and, you know, And we would have pseudo Bobbies. There would somebody, you watch him. He's doing your part, Neil.
Yeah, they would make them wear, or at least when we did Sweeney, we were in the same situation. You would wear a big placard that would say Sweeney.
Yeah.
Like,
and so
like
goes Mary, back to the Mary Jane.
And go, they're moving there. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So now I have to ask you, I don't know how long you've known Miss LuPone, but it seems like there's great chemistry there. It feels like you guys have been married for quite some time with each other.
Well, that's very good because I met her during rehearsals.
You had never crossed paths.
I'd never met her before. I'd seen her work, of course.
Of course. Yeah.
And I was nervous about it. And just, you know, because you know, not so much that she has a reputation, but she's like a household name and such a talent. But she was very kind to me. Her husband, I forget his name, forgive me, grew up 30 miles from where I grew up.
Oh.
Yeah, he's Kokomo, Indiana. And I was like, Kokomo? Oh, come on. We used to go to the shopping center there because, you know, whatever. I had a doctor there. He's like, but she was fun. She worked really hard. And I was told, you know, that she basically expects everyone to work hard. Mm-hmm. And if you're slouching or you're goofing off, she has no patience for it. I said, well, that's good. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. And we got on very well. And I enjoyed being her husband for that week or two. I guess we rehearsed a couple of weeks. But I haven't seen her since, you know. And
it's the nature of the business.
But we were very relaxed and, you know.
Yeah.
What do you like out of a scene partner, especially in the rehearsal process? What traits do you enjoy?
Well, I do like someone like Mrs. LuPone, who does her homework and knows what she's doing and talks to you, looks you in the eye, and you know what I mean? Who's ready to engage.
Listening
that helps.
And
yeah.
Engaged, yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
I guess it's preparedness and accessibility.
Accessibility, that's great.
Yeah.
That's good.
But I like it also from a reader when I'm auditioning, because a lot of times you get, if you're auditioning, the reader has the script kind of up to their face, and then you don't get any eye contact.
Right.
Every once in a while you do, and it's like, it makes a world of difference, because that's what humans do. We talk to each other. We don't read lines. Then, then you're asking me to just
to react
fake
to
it
what?
Up. Yeah. I've just got to fake, of course, I'm in love with you, too.
Yeah.
Do you still like the auditioning process?
That
implies like you liked it before, so I should ask you, do you enjoy auditioning, period?
A lot of times I do. Sometimes I don't, and it's hard for me to understand why I have a good audition or why I don't.
Yeah.
I like it when I have a lot of time to prepare. I like to have a lot of time because it takes me a while to get past my own bad habits, my first choices, because that's just it. I find that as an actor, I have to start making choices early because there usually isn't time to let it germinate. I'm going to ask myself this question, and then 3 days from now, I might have the answer to what it is that makes this character tick. Because it can take that long.
Yeah.
It could take even longer. But you don't have that time, and so you... I found that I've had to manufacture what I believe is the truth of a character. And if I don't really believe it, then it's hard for me to really emotionally commit to it. But if I have the time and I find it, then I fall in love with it and I get it and I can commit to it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
I hate to say a rushed marriage, but it's almost like, well, you're asking me to do this when I'm not, I don't know what it is yet.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If I have time, that helps.
Got it.
Oh, that's good.
Do you still have a standard audition song that you use? Or
no. I mean, usually now it's, did you get the sides? Did you get the song they want you to sing?
Yeah. The 20, 30 pages of sides.
That's what I did. I auditioned for Sunset Boulevard. Yes.
You know what I mean? Here's eight songs.
Get a phone book of stuff.
And bring your book.
Yeah. And I sang The Lady's Paying from Sunset Boulevard and held copy because I only had 48 hours. I only had 2 days. But
thank goodness you play the piano at least.
Yes, that you can, I know, you know what I mean?
I've always found that to be a huge commodity,
huge head start for me.
Yeah,
because I can also think of all kinds of different songs. What song could I sing that will illuminate character? Usually, that's what it is. What song would I sing that will help illuminate this character?
Interesting. Yeah,
and it helps that I've played a bunch of songs. And
do you want to ask about the other hat that Mr. Walton wears, which is writer?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
You guys have done your research.
We have a little bit, but you've written with your brother.
Yes, Bob and I. Mm-hmm.
I love that. And how did that come about that you guys were like, hey, let's write a couple shows together?
Yeah. It started really back in 1991 when I was doing World Goes Round, and he was in City of Angels on Broadway.
Love it.
And he said, what if we did a Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS night at... The Triad.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
72nd.
Yeah. It's now stage 72, I think.
Is that what it's called?
Stage 72 / Triad.
I feel like Jacques Brel is always there. What I feel like.
It was called DeGraw. It wasn't even called the Triad then. Huh. Steve McGraw.
Oh, yeah.
Steve McGraw. So we said, all right. He said, you know, we could do some of our originals. We didn't write songs together before that, mind you. We hadn't written together.
Oh, wow.
He writes music and lyrics. And plays the piano. I write music and lyrics and play the piano. So we gathered a bunch of songs, some good, some bad. Not bad, but just like, really? Are we going to do this? And we wrote a couple of songs for it and did it and just clowned around and had our friends there and they laughed at everything we said. And so we felt like we owned the world.
Was that Brother's Keeper?
My Brother's Keeper. Uh-huh. Very good. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. For want of a bit, we went, well, what if we just call him My Brother's Keeper?
It's good. It's a good title.
You know.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it's a little standard, but you know. And then after that, we did it a few more times at the Triad and other places. Then we realized, well, we need to write a show that we can do. We need to write a book musical either for us to do or others to do. Not a review about brothers. It's just there's not enough to hang an evening on. So we wrote, I had seen The Mystery of Irma Vep.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Which you may know is a two-hander in which they play many roles. And I thought, well, Bob, why don't we write a two-hander for ourselves in which we play 8 to 10 characters going on and off stage? And so he wrote the libretto, and then we both wrote the score to what was called Double Trouble.
That's so cool.
Which is basically about a brother's songwriting team that goes to Hollywood because they get a chance to write this one big song for this musical, this movie that's filming, and they need to write it quickly and the crazy characters they meet there.
That's great.
Is this available for licensing?
Yes, it is. It's through R&H. R&H Theatricals.
All right. So R&H has...
Oh, check that out.
Double Trouble, a musical tour de farce.
See what you did there.
That's farce, funny. Usually.
Oh, thank you, Jim.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah, not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.